There we go. So I was asked to take just a couple minutes to talk about and name the need as it has looked on Shabig in respect to housing. It was also requested in our last call. There'll be a further document about this shared on shabig.org in the near future. But for now, the synopsis is that there's been a huge outmigration of young people on Shabig, starting all the way back in World War II and continuing on to today. Many of the people that have come to the island, to retire. And based on data, Shabig actually has the oldest average population of any of the main islands. In the 1980s, the concerns about sustainable housing options started to increase when property values spiked, and people began to buy what were rentals and turned them into investment properties. And this really affected people who would have been able to rent, being able to stay on the island and sustain themselves on the island. And also it affected people's ability to afford houses and lots of land, especially, and this really also affected young people who'd grown up on the island. So we know that the pandemic has increased demand on your limited housing stock. And there's been a history of efforts all the way from the 1990s up through today that people have envisioned in different iterations to try and address that. Those examples will be included in that document on shabig.org. So I want to briefly introduce our panelists, to whom we are very grateful for having joined us tonight. I don't think I see Roger. Okay. So first we have Marla O'Byrne, who's the Executive Director of the Island Housing Trust, Mount Desert Isle. Rick Rogers, Executive Director of Islesboro Affordable Property. Ellen Ellis-Soffin, who's the Secretary of the Vinyl Haven Planning Commission and the Vinyl Haven, and is here from the Vinyl Haven Housing Committee. And we are so grateful to have you here tonight to share your experiences. Thank you so much. So I also just wanted to very, very briefly explain the agenda, what tonight will look like. There will be two questions that we will volley to our three presenters, and each of them will answer the same questions. After this first question, we'll have a few minutes for a question and answer from all of you in the community. And the same again when we ask our second question. In our closing, we'll kind of talk about next steps, and we're committed to close at 8:15 sharp. Okay, thanks everybody. Okay, so I will get us started. The first question, and maybe Marla, we can start with you, and then we can go to Rick and then to Ellen. So what was the need you were trying to meet when you developed your project, and what did you design to try and meet that need?
The need was identified through a grassroots community visioning called MDI Tomorrow in the early 2000s. And we started with a blank slate and asked the community, what do you value about Mount Desert Island, what do you worry about, and what would you like to see in the future? And workforce housing was one of three issues that came up. So it was a recognition that year-round housing, rentals, and purchases were dwindling, and that the gap between median income, a median sales price, and median income was widening. So Island Housing Trust started out by having a housing study, identifying how many houses we thought we could provide and what the market would bear. We were very idealistic and set a really high number that we still haven't achieved. But because it was grassroots and because it was a community effort, we had a lot of contacts, and that brought a lot of ideas to the table, and got the attention of one of the towns that had 10 acres that had been donated with the restriction that it was for workforce housing some point in the future. So there we were forming. Town of Mount Desert came to us, asked us if we were ready to try and take on this project. It was about 3 years into forming the organization, and that's where we started, was with donated land. donated house design that had won the Maine State Housing Greenhouse Design Award in 2006. And fundraising. We just went out and started fundraising. In the years leading up to that, the two or three summers leading up to that, we'd had parties to reach out to donors and explain, you know, what it was that we were trying to do. Oh, you're on mute.
I knew I would regret that decision. Thank you. Thank you, Marla. Rick, I have the same question for you. What was the need you were trying to meet when you developed your project, and what did you design to try and meet the need?
First, I'll say that IAPs was incorporated in 1989 and got 501c3 in 1990, which was about 20 years prior to my involvement with the organization. So I can't really speak other than what Marla said. I think we've all found from doing these island get-togethers at the Institute back before COVID, when we would all get in the same room, we all pretty much have exactly the same issues. Scale can be a little different depending on the size of your island population, but we pretty much all have the same issues. Islesboro had the same issues that Marla was talking about, which was there was a group of community members who identified the fact that property values were increasing beyond the means of workaday people. And they created the organization Islesboro Affordable Property, got donated land, fundraised, hired an architect. That architect designed three different kit homes. The owners to be, because those were built, the first eight houses were built on a community land trust model, built their own houses with community support through from some contractors. Electricians and plumbers would come in and help them out on the more technical things, but generally speaking, they built their own houses. That was the first eight back in the early to mid 90s, okay? So I always talk about three eras at IAP. The first era was the original eight houses, which we call the Ruthie James subdivision. And then momentum kind of dropped off. Nothing happened for about a decade after that. And then new blood came in at the board of directors and they started to build houses again, but their model changed from the community land trust model to a build to sell model. That didn't work out so well. They built two houses, bought one, ended up selling one, ended up not being able to close on a second, and then renting that for the same person for over a decade now. And the third one we did, we bought a house. That person did most of the renovations there himself, and we ended up selling it to him at a big discount. So that we did do, we tried to do three build or buy to sell, completed two of those. And then since 2011-ish, it's been build to rent model because we feel like we have a better control over what the market is and that's what we charge and the maintenance of the affordability and things like that. So the three eras are the community land trust, the build to sell, and then the build to rent model. All of the things that Marla talked about are exactly the same. I think you'll find that pretty much on every unbridged island. They're very, very similar issues.
Similar issues, and it's all about finding the right fit for your individual community, which I feel like.
Well, I mean, when we got, sorry, just to jump back in, we all got together and you all talk about the same thing, affordability of housing, workforce housing. And then if you stick around long enough, you'll start talking about, for those who do have a school, you'll start talking about maintenance of the school by finding young families and trying to support them to bring their children onto the island to fill up your schools with. That's always another hot topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and senior housing as well. Absolutely. Thank you, Rick. Ellen, can you tell us a little bit about the need that you've experienced on Vinyl Haven and what you've designed to meet that need thus far? One of the reasons we have this scope of presenters is that they're all at different stages in their process, and we thought that would be really interesting to you all and speak. Ellen, you're on mute. Ellen, you're muted.
We're a bit behind Rick and Marla. We're still sort of trying to figure it out. In conversation with Jason Bird, who I met when the housing committee existed some years ago, he came out and someone from HUD came out, and it was my impression that we really needed numbers. We really needed concrete information in order to try to create housing. We couldn't just say we need it and someone would come and build it. So we got with the support of Nick from the Island Institute and the Town Select Board, we got a little bit of money together and hired a consultant, Mary Terry, who's worked on some of the islands. Perhaps some of you have worked with her. She's a wonderful person, very generous with her time and her skills and her knowledge. And we did created a survey, sent it out. We had it available through the town website. We had a Facebook link that Matt Jablonski, who's the Island Fellow on Vinyl Haven, helped with. He was a big help. We had paper copies at stores all over town. The only place we didn't really have it was at the bar. That might have been a mistake. But we had it everywhere, hoping that a lot of people would fill it out. It was meant to be anonymous. They were collected and sent to Mary directly. People didn't have to give their names or any identifying information because we really wanted people to be as honest as they possibly could be. We reached a lot of people, and some people filled it out who really weren't housing challenged. So that was a little curious. But the last page was, because I'm one of the founders of the elder care services on the island. I've been very concerned about elder issues forever. So the last page was a half a page asking specifically people over 65. Seems to me that's a little young, but anyway, to find out what their needs were, whether they were struggling, you know, with heat issues, tax issues, maintenance issues, just things like that, because I don't think just building houses is the solution. I think there are lots of different things. I think there are young people struggling. There are older people struggling. We have several apartment buildings here that are for low income and people with physical challenges, but some of those apartments are upstairs, and that's not good for a lot of the older people or people with physical problems. So if we could build something new that has an elevator, which would be really quite amazing to have an elevator on Vinyl Haven, but that's probably what we need. Maybe some of the older people who don't want to move out of their homes, which is understandable, would move into some place that was more comfortable and affordable and easier to get to groceries and sociability and everything. And then that might open up some of the older, bigger homes for some kind of renovation to help the younger people stay here and have bigger living opportunities. So we've just gotten our assessment back from Mary. It's big, it's complicated, it's frankly, it's hard to wrap your head around it, but we're putting it out into the community. Paper copies of the executive summary I put out yesterday. There'll be a link to it on the town website. Mary made a PowerPoint, so that's going to be available to people too. If they don't want to sit down and read it, they can just sit back on their laptop or their computer and listen to it. And the next tasks that we've gotten the select board to authorized are to look at our land use ordinance. I'm secretary of the Planning Commission, and we're going to look at the ordinance and see what changes we think would be useful in terms of, you know, setback, lot density, parking issues. But frankly, that's a really complicated process. And I'm wondering if any of you have been through that process, because we really need help. It's just, we can't just pick numbers out of the air. We have to really know what the impacts are going to be. So I've reached out to our town manager and to Nick and spoken with a couple of planners. We really need professional help for this. We're also going to research who does housing heat audit, energy audits, and see if we could get someone to come out and do that for people who sign up, and then see if we can get some grant money to try to make that happen. We're going to look at town-owned parcels and large parcels that might be able to be donated to create housing, if that looks like something that we could do. And I think that's pretty much our tasks for now. But they're complicated. They're big tasks. But we want the community to really know we're taking this seriously this time, that we are going to move forward. We're moving forward very quickly within the committee. We meet very often, at the most every 2 weeks. I mean, at the least every 2 weeks. I think it's really important to keep the momentum going for people on the committee to really feel that we're engaged, that we're focused on what we're doing, that we're thinking about it, and we're not forgetting what we talked about last time when we meet the next time.
Well put, Ellen. Well put, Ellen. Absolutely, yes, thank you. And those resources that Ellen just mentioned will also be posted on chibik.org, the report and presentation. Marla, did you want to say?
Could I just add a couple of things?
Please.
I was very literal and just said where we started and what we did. So I agree with Rick. Building is not, you can't build your way out of this challenge. And so one of the things I'd say is Island Housing Trust started with donated land and building 10 homes. but then we realized that some people could just about afford a house on the island, but often didn't have the money, sufficient money for a down payment to make it manageable for them. So Island Housing Trust raised funds to help with down payments in exchange for covenants that kept those houses affordable and kept that money moving forward with the house. We've accepted a donation of a house as well as land to put that house on. And we have purchased, renovated, and resold at a lower price houses that have been on the market. And another opportunity now that we're seeing is working with homeowners who want to sell their house, but they want to make sure that it doesn't go into a seasonal rental. They want it to remain year-round, and they want to help be part of protecting their year-round neighborhood. So we've had a couple of homeowners who have lowered the price of their house to where they can get back what they need to. Island Housing Trust puts in a large bit of change. Actually, it's fairly efficient for us still. And then we can sell it at the price cap that we have set for our homes. And so there are lots of different opportunities that your community will help you figure out. And being responsive is really so important in finding those opportunities.
Thank you, Marla. Thanks for mentioning that affordability piece, because we hear affordable housing so often, but acknowledging that different income brackets are important part of the equation on islands where we have a higher cost of living is really important. I just want to ask Roger, is that you on the phone?
Yes, it is, Rhea.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Roger is our fourth panelist. He was having a little bit of problems with his computer. Perfect timing. Roger, Burley is from Sustainable Cliff Island. Can you remind me of your title, Roger?
Yes, I'm a founding director and treasurer. We have a board of four board members, and we founded ourselves in 2013, but really kicked into gear after we found that we were not going to get enough critical mass to think about seceding from the city of Portland, because we are the most remote neighborhood of the city of Portland. We're 6 miles out to sea, not like Matinicus, but we're still separated by water. And then in 2015, a very wonderful person who worked for the city of Portland called me up one day and said, we're holding a property that I think is very important to your community, and we can sell it for taxes for $50,000+, but we thought we ought to give Sustainable Cliff Island a shot at it. So we did. Now, I don't know if you want me to continue, because I will.
Yeah, please just spend a couple more minutes telling us a little bit about what your work looks like today.
Okay, so we did purchase this property, which used to be a former year-round store with a fuel dock, a house available for year-round residency. And we started working on this property when all of a sudden a former year-round home dropped in our lap. We had to pay for it, a couple of $100,000. But what we've done, this is a home on the northwest side, or the traditional summer side of the island, but a very substantial home, and been through a series of owners. But at one time, actually, one of our long-term resident teachers owned it. Then she had to move off the island and so forth. And while we're just getting started putting together all the pieces for the Fisherman's Wharf property that I started with here, this house dropped on our lap. We realized that we've always wanted to have teacher housing on Cliff Island, never had it before unless someone happened to live here. We're now in more than halfway through turning this former formidable home into two apartments. The upstairs apartment is was finished in February, and it houses our teacher. And so forever, we will have teacher housing on Cliff Island. There's one woman and a dog living there now, a great teacher. It's also suitable if she had a child or a spouse or a partner as well. And we're well into the renovating the downstairs apartment, which will be for an already engaged year-round person. So we also have our fingers into a year-round home that is owned by a man with no interested heirs, long born and raised on Cliff Island. He's old, he's worried, he's got problems with his maintaining the systems in his house. We are in early on stage of essentially doing a responsible reverse mortgage with him, paying for his expenses, taxes, et cetera, improvements, repairs. And then at 86, he'll be dying at some point, and we hope to land that. And we're looking at two other homes. And so we're a group of people who are fortunate enough to find a couple of $100,000 to help us with these projects. It's 90% free labor from the community. And we're moving on. We hope to have that second apartment done before summer of 2022 and move back to the original Fisherman's Wharf property and so forth. So now some other options appear to be popping up to us. And we don't have very deep pockets, but we have enough to move forward for a couple of years. And we're hoping that we can serve our community in this way. Because like everything else I heard from the other islands just now, we're in the same place. We have about 50 year-rounders, and we've had as many as 150 a century ago. But we're working with what we got. We're gaining some admirers with checkbooks and some supporters for investments. And so we're working on all of that. We want to show those who've given us money before what we've done with it and then ask for more. So that's about it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Roger. That's a lot. That it is a lot. Thank you so much. I now want to open it up for questions. We just have about 10 minutes per cycle of questions, unfortunately, in this brief hour and 15 minutes that we have together. You can ask a question two ways. You can go down and raise your hand. I'm always trying to remember how to do that. Oh, hit the reactions button and you'll see the little thing that says raise your hand, or you can just old fashioned raise your hand and we'll try our best to see it. So a question for anyone on our panel, Marla, Rick, Ellen, or Roger on the phone. Oh, there we go. Megan.
Hello.
Hello.
I have a question for Roger, and then I have a question for Rick. Roger, does the Sustainable Cliff Island own all those properties? How does ownership work with those?
Well, so far, good question. We wish we started this 60 years ago when all those year long gone fishing families left, but we didn't. We started about 5-6 years ago. So we own now two properties. The one we are two-thirds of the way through turning into two apartments. We completely own the Fisherman's Wharf property, which is of huge community importance traditionally and in the future. And if we can pull together this project, so-called responsible reverse mortgage project, with this 86-year-old born and raised Islander, seems to be positively inclined to so far, we will own that property. And then we also have an option that's with a small O, not legal, on a piece of open space that was saved from going to preservation. That's what I do, is preservation. But in this case, we've got the potential to build three brand new houses. Our plate is full, almost too full, but we're going to keep all the balls up in the air as much as possible. We intend to own whatever we were dealing with in response to ultimately selling a piece of property, we would keep as many restrictions in our favor as possible. So that's it.
Thanks, Roger. I'm going to move ahead to Donna, and if we have a chance, we'll circle back to you, Megan, for your second question, as we're limited for time here. Donna.
Yeah, just a quick question for Marla. What kind of a covenant did you write, did you put on those properties so that you would be able to keep them affordable in the future?
Our covenants require that people live in the house year round, that they offer Island Housing Trust the right of first refusal when they come to purchase it. It establishes a resale formula that ties the resale price of the house to the median income at the time of sale. So it starts with the price they paid, incorporates the changes in the median income from the time they purchased to the time they're selling, and keeps those affordable. And it travels, it's part of the deed. It's recorded in the registry and carries with the property.
Thanks, Marla.
Yeah.
I also heard that Sarah Hopkins was waving her hand. There you are, Sarah.
Hello, thank you. I was hearing that there was a lot of donated land, donated housing. I love the reverse mortgage idea. I wonder though, if any of these communities have worked with the Maine state government and HUD and used any of those financing mechanisms on the housing projects.
Island Housing Trust has not. We work with incomes that are higher than what are allowed for some of these programs. We are going to apply to the Maine State Housing Affordable Subdivision Program, which does allow median incomes up to 120% of median income, which we're using as our eligibility criteria in our new neighborhood. Yeah.
Thanks, Mark. And Rick, you wanted to add?
Go ahead, Nick, I'll wait.
I was just going to say that that program that Marla mentioned will be receiving some new money that will be getting rolled out pretty soon with a slightly different program rules that make it easier for communities to access.
Really soon, like in the next couple of weeks, right?
Yeah.
Great. And Rick, you wanted to add on to that?
Yes. I've heard the same thing through Genesis Fund and through a couple other sources that money's coming by the end of the year. That's what I'm hearing. I haven't heard a specific date. If it's if those of you who have availed yourself of that back in, I think it was 2010, are going to be, I think, fairly familiar with how it's going to roll out again this next time. But specifically to Sarah's question, what I've found, like going to a Maine housing program, most of their funding formulas don't work out particularly well for islands because the scale, you know, a two house development on Islesboro is a big deal. But when you go to Maine housing, when you start filling in the blanks, you need more of a 8, 10, 12, 14 unit thing to make it work for a lot of their programming. So the only one that we've used through Maine Housing is the 2010, I believe it was, Island Initiative that we built two houses with that money. So,
thanks, Rick. And Megan, if we could have our last question from Megan be quick with a brief answer, we can.
Okay, quick question. Do any of you employ, like Rick, I think you do this for a living and everyone else volunteers?
Oh. Let me shake my head, yes.
Yes.
I am a paid employee, that's correct.
Okay, and everyone else is pretty much volunteer?
Island Housing Trust has 4 staff members.
Wow, 4? 4, wow.
Wow, where do I get my 3 helpers at?
And Ellen, you're a volunteer. Roger, how about you?
Yes, I'm a volunteer. We are all 4 board members are volunteers, and a couple of spouses are pitching in volunteer too, but we'll We have paid for some labor, but it's probably 80, 90% volunteer.
Okay, great question. Thank you. Thanks so much. All right, I'm going to move us along to our second question. Two out of two for our panelists. And again, the same question to all of you. We'll start again with Marla. So Marla, what advice would you give to a community like Shabig that's just kind of starting anew and investigating and working on this issue? Any lessons learned, good places to start, advice in general for this stage in the process?
I think it's reaching out and finding the skills and that you need working with you. It's understanding what the issue is, being able to put numbers to it so people can understand. Working with a broad brush of people from the community for solutions. A lot of what has come to us has come because word of mouth, people have ideas or they know about opportunities. I think it's good to have legal volunteers on your board. An accountant is good because there may be tax benefits for donors of different types of not just money, but land or property. So getting as many different skills around the table with you and ideas and having the community helping develop the solutions also is important. It helps reduce any confusion or controversy. It just diffuses some of that, and it generates excitement and hope among the community, and that goes a long way to moving things forward.
Thanks, Marla. And we have a great comment from John Wilson that, you know, two fine rental units have been built on Shabig with Maine Housing Authority money, donated land, and a lot of donations from good people. So acknowledging that, you know, there have been efforts and an action happening on Shabig, but this is a new iteration of that effort in this new time and climate. So thanks for that reminder. I can't read all the comments. I'm going to get distracted. Rick, I'll ask you the same question. Any advice for Shabig as they're in this new phase of digging into the issue, lessons learned, recommendations?
Sure. Marla and I are on the same page a lot here. It seems you need to find a group of people that are willing to spend significant amount of times, especially when you're starting to crank up, because there's going to be a lot of work to do. And I wrote down some people here. Like, if you can find somebody that's got a finance background, a construction background, a fundraising background, a grant writing background, a legal background, if you can find anybody in that hemisphere, they're going to be of a big benefit to what you're going to try to do. The second thing I would say is that you need to define the problem, your specific problem. You need to have a mission statement and you need to stick to it. Part of the problem with, you know, is that you write down, you'll get an idea about what you want to do, and then people will try and like pull you in a little different direction or get you to do something a little different than your mission statement is. So my suggestion is to write a mission statement, avoid mission creep. And in the mission statement, our mission statement, I should have pulled it out so I could read it, but you need to define who it is you're trying to help, how you're going to go about doing it. And this is a big one for Islesboro, is what are the people that you're trying to help going to bring to your community? You know, there has to mm-hmm. be, you know, we require that the people that we help, our mission is to help those people who are going to help us maintain a year-round viable community. Okay, that is the chief thing about people we help. What job do you have? Do you have children that fit in our school? What do you bring to what do the people that you're trying to help bring to the table to help the community?
Thanks, Rick. I love everybody loves a clear directive. Ellen. There you are. Same question for you. What advice might you have for the community of Shabig, knowing that you're in a similar early stage of your work? What have you learned that might be help inform their process?
Well, I just learned a lot from Roger.
from Ricky and Rick. We have Rogers and Rick Rogers. It's a little tough tonight. Yeah.
Well, and Rick, we're going to be working on a mission statement pronto.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I think it's really important to have the community involved and to have people from the year-round community. I've been involved with the island here. You know, we've had a summer home here for a very long time. And there are other people from away who live here year-round like me. But to have islanders who really know the community, who really know the problems, who have family, who've, you know, struggled to find housing, who really know what the issues are, I think that's really valuable. And I'm really very grateful for their participation.
Yeah, Rick?
I wrote some notes. My second to last note was very much what Ellen was saying, which is, you need to know if the community's behind what you're doing. If the community's not on board, you're going to have lots of issues. And you need to know whether I don't know what governing body runs your island, but if it's a board of selectmen or whatever, you need to find out if they're on board. And if they're not, you need to get some sort of an educational program going to show to try and get them to co-opt them onto your side of the argument. Because if you're bucking the government and you're bucking the community, you're never going to get there from here.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, they're on board.
Good.
Fortunately, we're here at the invitation of the town of Shabig. But I understand what you're saying in terms of whatever solution you define, that you need endorsement of that specific solution, not just of the existence of the need. So thanks for that.
I mean, it's good to have the town on board, but I don't know how many people that is. But is that you talking about the town government or are you talking about the population at large? Because they're not always the same thing.
Very true. I was talking about the town government. Yeah. Thanks, Rick. Roger, could you pipe in and answer the same question? What advice?
I can't type in, but I'll do it verbally quickly. We are fortunate, I guess, in this regard, not to be a town here in Cliff Island. We're also fortunate to be relatively small. That also reduces our ability to take in contributions. But other than that, we have a board of four director trustees who get along great. We all have construction backgrounds. I have fundraising background. We've got a lot of that covered, what I think Rick was saying before. And so we were able to go from scratch to full broadband in a year. And because we didn't have to deal with anyone but ourselves, we had a guy who was good at it. We had good support from a handful of people here, a couple of island meetings, and boy, it was done in very short order. And we are essentially trying to go in that same spirit and that same direction and generally that same mode with our housing situation.
So how would you translate that into advice for people who might not have the same free and clear status?
Well, the towns, I know that some islands still don't have full broadband or broadband, to my limited knowledge. I haven't. So, again, we're keeping our efforts in the island. We haven't received a dollar from anyone off island. We hope at some point to write grants. But I guess lean and mean and focused and able to relate to people on the island or have them relate to us and what we're trying to do. Again, that's a benefit of being small, but not too small. I think we're about the ideal size for continuing to pull off this project.
Thank you. Thanks, Roger. And I was reminded that tonight is sponsored by the Board of Selectmen from the town of Shabig, just to be specific and clear. Thank you. I would love to open it up now for a few minutes of questions. That was our last directed question that we had for our panelists. You can ask them questions as to the advice that they just offered. I know that we've been kind of chomping at the bit in these conversations to share ideas and versions of what solutions could look like for Shabig, which will be included in our third and final call. But if there's any ideas that you've been chewing on that you would love to put in the form of a question to any of our panelists or any other areas of inquiry that you have, please raise your hand in real life, or you can go down to the reactions button and hit the raise your hand button. Ben.
This is a question for all our panelists. One thing that I've been thinking about a lot as we begin tackling this problem is how it's not something that one organization can take on, but that every island organization has a stake in this. The school has a stake in this. The church has a stake in it. The town government has a stake in it. All the island nonprofits have a stake in it, because this is about our future viability as a year-round community. And hearing you all reminded me the importance of doing really careful community building and consensus building and coalition building, which we all know in any community, and perhaps particularly in small communities, requires a high degree of intention. One of the things I'm really impressed by listening to you all is clearly the intention with which many of you have brought that to your work. So this is really a community-owned project that the community feels like it's behind. And I wonder if you might be able to give us any advice about what it looks like to build those sorts of coalitions to tackle a systemic problem like this, which won't be solved just by, as someone mentioned, building more units, but it's really about people and community and an interlocking set of dynamics. So any advice for us as we begin this process and look to build similar similar coalitions and similar consensus?
Yeah, Marla. Well, I think I was going to have Marla. Go ahead, Roger.
This is real quick. We have on our limited board of directors, we have a lot of cross membership with other important Cliff Island nonprofits and the ones that are energetic. We got feet here and there planted all across the community. That's all I'll say. It's good.
Thank you, Roger. That's great. Marla?
I was just going to say that we've been active for about 15, 16 years, and we struggle with that all the time. We try and make sure we get articles in the paper that are relevant to what we're doing, but also to the issue. We have our board members write op-ed pieces. We have letters to the editor. We have a Facebook page, and we continue to try to build that. And we post in various other Facebook page sites so people understand what it is we are working on and trying to do. We had library talks this summer, two of those by Zoom, and we reached over 100 people that way. So we continue to try to build that awareness and affiliation, people feeling like they're part of it. But I will say that Deer Isle is very interesting. I wanted to mention this last time. They have a housing group, the Island Workforce Housing on Deer Isle, Stonington. And they were, they're working on 10 duplexes for rentals, and they were hitting a wall with the select board. And they had, I don't know, like 40 or 50 people show up at a town meeting because they sent emails out saying, we're reaching this. And if you want to help make this happen, we need you there at the meeting of the select board and express your support. And they reversed that kind of opposition from the select board, as I understand it. So it is important. And there are many ways you just keep trying to reach out and get people's contact information so you can keep them informed and ask for their help.
Thanks, Marla. Thanks for that perspective as well. I see you there, Jeff, and I see you there, Richard, with your hands up. I do want to acknowledge that Bob Ernest typed in a question. He says, to the wonderful folks here from other islands, are there agencies other than Maine Housing and Genesis with whom you've worked? So for any of you.
I would say one of our really good early partners was Maine Coast Heritage Trust, and it doesn't necessarily rise to your first thought, but MCHT and other local land trusts look at the properties, and they often have their conservation criteria. And if land comes up where some portion of it doesn't meet that conservation criteria, but the rest of it does, we have found we've been able to do 3 projects with MCHT. With that sort of land, they keep us in mind. So it's a good relationship to build, I'd say. And then our housing authority as well, we're working with them.
Your local housing authority, yeah. Thank you, Marla. Anyone else have an answer to that question? Rick?
Not sure it's the answer to the question, but I'll tell you another place to go if you have this opportunity is a local bank. One of them is retired now, but at one time I had a fairly close relationship with two vice presidents at Camden National Bank. And if they're willing to play ball and hold loans and portfolio and things like that, you can get some really beneficial financing and get some home loans for people who probably or may not be able to qualify on their own. A good banker who's willing to work with your organization can really help you out. I would try and generate some sort of relationship with a banker if I could.
Mm. Thanks. Roger, did you want to pipe in on that?
No, we have not looked any further. We have worked with Genesis and AdviceWise, but that's about it so far.
So good so far. And Alan, I don't know if you all are at that stage yet, if that feels comfortable, if that feels relevant to you.
Well, Jason Bird, we've talked to him and we've had Zoom meetings with him. They do a lot of different programs through PenQuist, and I think he seems like a possible partner, but I know there are other builders. We're hoping that we can find various solutions, some building, some adapting, mm-hmm. some zoning changes, some accessory structures maybe turned into tiny homes, maybe even a mobile home park if the community would go for that. So we're just thinking of what we can do. It's curious and interesting to me that Owlsboro and some of you have actually created your own housing authorities, that you're actually owning and buying, and you know, that seems really monumental.
Yes, there's some amazing examples of work that is the result of long and committed efforts for sure. Thanks, Ellen. Richard Hackle? I'm not sure that's you, Richard, but I want to let you go ahead and ask your question.
There's Richard. This is actually Jenny Hackle. And,
hi, Jenny.
I apologize. I didn't get to join the meeting until 7:30, but yeah. I'm curious if any of the experts are familiar with co-housing, which is kind of short for cooperative housing. I lived in cooperative housing when I was in college, and then we lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and a co-housing was built for, you know, multiple generations. People actually bought their units, and but people cooperate with, you know, snow removal, one playground that's shared, et cetera. And, you know, obviously our town zoning would need to make an exception for co-housing, but it seems to me a really great way to share the cost of housing, as well as sharing the resources that the group of residents can benefit from each other's skills and energies.
Yeah, thanks, Jenny. Is anyone here familiar with co-housing models as a possible solution, or has dabbled in that? Marla, you're smiling.
Yeah, it was something we talked about with our first development. And then I'd say that we stepped back from it because we felt that we would be imposing our philosophy on people. And we wanted to know that this would be something people wanted. So I think it's been in the back of our mind, if we had a group of people who were interested in it and it could be year-round and affordable, we could work with them. But Belfast, of course, has a good example of that too. It's not affordable, but it is year-round, and it is a very diverse community, as I understand.
Yeah, thanks, Marla. And a great resource to look into for that is the Cooperative Maine Business Alliance, which supports the development and sustainability of cooperatives across Maine. And they have a really strong presence in the Midcoast area. And they're the main arm of the Cooperative Development Institute. So the Cooperative Maine Business Alliance is something there.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jenny. Jeff, you've been very patient. We'd love to hear from you. Jeff Suma, you're muted. Microphone button, the red microphone button.
Okay, can you hear me now? Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk and ask the presenters. On your various islands, have you encountered any pushback from the community with what you're doing? And if so, how have you dealt with that in moving forward?
Great question.
Well, here on Cliff Island, no pushback of any note that we have heard. Doesn't mean people don't grumble about us trying to change things or do things when they're sitting over their own kitchen tables. That's from Cliff Island.
Thanks, Islesboro, man. The genesis of the organization was grassroots. The community is pretty much behind the everything we do. So you might hear, you know, the original eight houses in Ruthie James, you might hear one derogatory term you hear every now and then is the projects kind of a thing, because they are 30 odd years old now. And you know, they're some of the owned houses are maybe not as well kept as they could be. But the community writ large is very supportive of Islesboro Affordable Property. And the summer community is hugely behind the Islesboro Affordable Property.
Thanks. Any pushback on Vinyl Haven or MDI?
I would say on MDI, in the early days, we would hear the occasional, I had to buy my own house. Why should somebody be helping other people buy a house? They can do it on their own. That was early. And in the past couple of years, we have heard more along the lines of people who apply who don't quite have the income eligibility, they earn too much, or we don't have the stock. That's been the bigger problem, is we just don't have the stock available, and they walk away disgruntled, and I can't blame them. You know, you were no help to me. And they're right, we aren't at that moment, but that's kind of what we hear.
Yeah, thank you. And I wanted to say that there's a note that Ellen had been talking about working with Jason Burdick Penquist, and Penquist is the community action agency in the Midcoast area. So thanks for that, Nick. Ellen, did you have any notes on that pushback at this early stage?
Well, the zoning could be a problem, because mm-hmm. there have been some permit applications, and some of the neighbors didn't like the idea of one building being turned into four units next door to them. So I'm a little concerned about that. But, you know, if people really want more housing, we have to change the ordinance. And that's true on all the islands. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of big old houses. I mean, there's some houses that went to foreclosure that got sold for very little money that could have been 2 and 3 family homes. Mm-hmm. There are lots of opportunities out there, and it's just a shame not to take advantage of them. So we're going to do our best and try to sell it to the community and see what happens. But all we can do is try.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ellen. Rick, yeah? Yes?
I'm going to ask the other panelists a question.
Okay.
What I just heard is not really what's going on Islesboro. Mm-hmm. I call them COVID refugees, kind of because starting in January of 2020, just to give you an example, 151 properties on Islesboro. Now, there are 600 year-round residents on Islesboro. 151 properties, about half of which were homes and about half of which were open land, changed hands on Islesboro Wow. between January the 1st and June the 30th of 2021. There is very little property available on Islesboro. There are virtually no houses available on Islesboro. And there are certainly no houses on Islesboro that are affordable anymore. Mm-hmm. Are any of the rest of you experiencing that too?
No, that's true here too. If I gave you the wrong impression, that wasn't meant to be.
Yeah.
Well, it's also true on Chabig.
On Cliff, we're not seeing as much of that as you guys are reporting mm-hmm. on the bigger islands.
Thanks, Roger. Marla, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, we're seeing that too. I've talked with bankers who tell me they're in tears because they've never worked so hard, and realtors who say they have just no properties left to sell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we heard from the state economist at the Institute recently that Knox County actually had the highest degree of homes sold across the state. And we already know that we're having really record home sales statewide as well. Eliza, I see you there. Eliza Jean Adams, we'd love to hear from you.
Oh, thank you for taking my question, and what a enlightening evening. It sounds like starting with rentals on our neighbors on Cliff is one of the good ways to start. But my question is that a housing authority? How does ownership work, and how is that managed? Thank you.
We're here on Cliff. We here on Cliff have no housing authority. Again, this is a nonprofit organization that is taking on what almost everyone here perceives as the greatest need, which is population, affordable residency, and people to get stuff done. And yes, we do tap into any talent on the island, which we heard about, I think, from Rick a half hour ago. So we're just doing it lean and mean, as I said a while ago. And so far it's working.
Thanks, Roger. Rick or Marla, I know you've spoken to your collaboration with the local housing authority, but there is that delineation there.
Yeah, we don't do rentals. We've just never had the capacity to take on rentals. So we're looking at potential partnerships, but yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. We have a couple of minutes to fit this in. So my colleague, Nick Batista, who's our senior policy officer, has offered to just speak for a minute on what's happening at the state level policy-wise around zoning, that recommendation that's supposed to come out in the next few days.
Yeah. So just, you know, Ellen mentioned zoning changes. It's come up a couple of times. The state legislature established a commission to look at the connection between zoning, land use, and housing in the state. They met a bunch of times this fall, produced a whole bunch of materials, worked on some draft recommendations. They're finalizing their report in the next couple of days. All of this is to say that the legislature this January, February, March will be spending some good time considering changes to zoning. And so that could include things like adding an accessory dwelling unit as a right. And so these would be state changes to zoning. It could include getting rid of single family zoning and allowing up to four units on a property. It could include technical assistance and support for communities that want to adapt their own zoning ordinances to improve housing options. And that would probably come with some carrots around funding to do other things. So all of this to say, there's going to be a pretty big statewide conversation. I don't know, but I suspect, you know, the second the legislature starts talking about zoning and having the state make decisions for communities, that the conversation will get contentious. But it will stay tuned for that. And if you're interested in knowing more, let me know. We can talk more in depth at a later point.
Yeah, you're welcome to reach out to myself or to Nick. It's our first initial last name at islandinstitute.org. We have another couple of great questions. We have a great question from Bob Ernest again. Do any of your programs envision a progression in which someone might rent for a while, but then move on to ownership?
IAP has done that once out of the 14 houses that we've developed. But he was at least a decade long renter, but we ended up selling it to him for substantially less money than we had in it because of his decade long association with the organization. But we don't do a rent to own model. We have done it once, however.
Thanks, Rick. Anyone else rent to own?
We haven't moved towards rent to own, but we have heard and have been considering, if we were to do rentals, that some portion of the rent might be set aside as an escrow for potential ownership, down payment sort of thing. It's a model we've heard other organizations have used. So,
yeah, very interesting. Thank you. And Bev, I heard you had your hand up and I missed you. So you want to go ahead and ask your question yourself?
Yes, I was curious. I'm really happy that you guys are all here. It's so informative. Do any of you who do renting require that you are part of the community, that you take part in some community organizations as part of the renting? And also, I was curious about contract zoning, if you've done any contract zoning as well.
So your first question about community involvement was, you gave the examples of, you know, is on the fire team, on a committee, a town employee, anyone have
as a requirement for renting.
Yeah, so did anyone have that integrated into the models of how they're approaching things? Rick?
I said that about an hour or so ago, but we have 6 rental units currently, and if the money from main housing comes through again, we'll build 2 more, and they'll be rental units, so we'll have 8 at that point. You know, if you're going to have rental units, and especially if you're going to have 8 rental units, you're going to need a paid employee. You're going to have to just get your mind around. You're going to have somebody that runs those rental units. Okay. I don't know what contract zoning is, so clearly we don't do that. but as far as you get moved up the list, I guess, when it comes to we have a selection committee. And after I vet their financials and take them to the selection committee, people who are integrated into the community who provide essential services to the community are at the top of that list, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, Rick, thank you. And we just have 3 minutes left in our question period. So I wanted to know if anyone else had a question to the contract zoning question. Do any of you have contract zoning?
What is it?
Donna, was your question?
Contract zoning is something that the state of Maine allows. And what you can do is, if you have a project that's creative, but it may not fit into your zoning, for example, our rec center, we use contract zoning on because it was next to the school. You can change setbacks. You can change the size, how many houses you get on a lot. And basically what happens is you enter into a contract with the town. And so it usually has to be for some benefit for the community. And so, for example, we have 1.5-acre zoning. And if we were going to do a project, we could have smaller house lots, if we say it was ownership, and you could put more land into open space, for example. But you wouldn't have to put it into open space. So it gives you an opportunity to actually write a contract, come up with a creative idea, and try to sell it to the community. And if you have a town meeting form of government, everyone in the community would have to vote on that to approve it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Donna. Okay, wonderful. Well, that brings us to our closing this evening. This has been a wonderful conversation, as I had a feeling it would be. Our next and last conversation will be Wednesday, January 12th at the same time from 7 to 8:15 p.m. The topic of that conversation is essentially going to be, what would it look like if Shabik's housing needs were met? So a little bit more of a time for you all to scratch around some ideas, especially having just heard some of the possibilities from our panelists here tonight. And then I'm really excited that following that, the Island Institute has committed to helping you through a community visioning workshop of sorts session. It's something that is still yet to be entirely designed, but that will be with our strategic lead for community leadership, Kate Tagai, who's joining us here on the call tonight. So we're really excited to have Kate join you for that, work with you on that. So the idea is that once we've explored the problem, which we did in call one, heard some input and ideas as we did on call 2, number 3, visioned and imagined, from that point, you will have an opportunity to turn that into some tangible next steps for your community. And we hope that will be of help to you. That is a TBD event, and it will be posted as soon as we have the details. I want to sincerely thank the panelists who joined us tonight on this chilly night, taking the time out of your days and lives to share your experiences. I know it's greatly appreciated by everyone on the call. And we do have some resources from each of the communities. We have the website link for the Island Housing Trust on MDI. We have a great write-up on Islesboro affordable property that is in the Island Institute Solutions Library. I have the link for that. Ellen and the Vinyl Haven Housing Committee have kindly shared the report that they just issued and spent so much time on that was a result of their community survey on housing. We have Sustainable Cliff Island, a link to that, and then also a resource that was recommended, which is the Grounded Solutions Network. So we can post all of that on shabib.org following this conversation. I thank you all so much, and it has been a delight. We'll see you in January.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Arden Institute.
Thank you, panelists.
Thank you, Bria. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.